thank you for, I can offer you to speak again. Okay. I'm happy to do it. So this is still joint work of Ben Green. Of course. So last time I motivated the main results we had, and I guess today I'll talk a little bit more about what goes into actually proving them. I was basically expanding on the last 5 minutes of the previous talk. The motivation was to count solutions to linear equations and primes. That was one of my first motivations. Okay. So, for example, you may want to count arithmetic progressions of some length, let's say length 3, which are all prime. So you can think of this type of problem. How many, say, progressions of length 3, say, are primes there, where all the primes are less than some large number n? More analytically, that problem is essentially the problem of trying to estimate a sum like this. Okay, trying to estimate this counting function summed over all n from 1 to n and r from 1 to n, where lambda is a von Mangold function, is defined to be log p when n is the power of p, and 0 otherwise. Just turns out to be a very good counting function for the primes. Every problem about linear equations of primes can be viewed as an expression, as a problem of computing sum like this. And one of the reasons why this is hard is because it's a little bit difficult, to understand this lambda function, and especially to have a sum with many, many lambdas in it. So, even to understand a sum with just one lambda in it, that's a prime number theorem, and that's already somewhat non-trivial. But this is the original motivation, and then we have this connection with this other problem, which is distribution of functions of primes. Mod 1. Just being a function of primes. So root 2p mod 1, how are these things distributed, root 2p squared mod 1, and then these funnier things, root 2, these bracket polynomials, root 2p, root 3p mod 1, and so forth. And analytically, these things correspond to estimating this sum, sums like this, where instead of having lambda, many lambdas, you just have one lambda, but then you have this. So you have one number, so here you have many number theoretic objects in your sum. Here you just have one number theoretic object and one dynamical object. So, for example, if you want to understand the distribution of primes root 2p mod 1, you need to understand exponential sums like this. Actually, more generally, you have to also consider integer modules of root 2, but essentially sums like this, or sums like this. And more generally, so the most general family of problems of this type that is of relevance is that of a no sequence, of correlating a prime with a no sequence. So it turns out that the correct framework to consider this problem is to understand averages like this, and for technical reasons we work with the Mobius function rather than the von Mangold function, but these are very closely related, lambda and mu. Mu is defined to be minus 1 to the k if n is the product of k primes and 0 otherwise. And these two functions are very closely related, for example, by this formula. Okay. So you want to understand this, where this is a nil sequence, so maybe I just recall you what a nil sequence is. Okay, a basic nil sequence. I won't tell you what a... a non-basic nil sequence is a uniform limit of basic nil sequences, but I'll never use those in this talk, so it's not... Okay. So a basic nil sequence is a sequence from n maps to a function of an orbit on a nil system where G lies in the group capital G. This is a nil potency group. So nilpotent, just remember that. So given any group, you can form it what's called the lower central series. So you take G, spectacle-physical, all commutators, and that spans a new group, a smaller group, G2. And then you can take commutators again, and you get G3, it's an even smaller group. And if at some point the iterated commutators become trivial, then we say that your group is nilpotent, and the step is S. Okay, so we have a nilpotent Lie group, and it will act on a compact quotient. So we take a discrete co-compact quotient. Actually, for technical reasons, we tend to assume that this nilpotent group is also connected and simply connected. Although these are just minor technical assumptions, it's not so essential. They're just convenient. Okay, so you have this co-compact quotient, so this gives you something which is, you should think of it as a generalized torus, maybe it's a good way to think about it. And the gx on this, and x is a point in here, so x is a point in this torus, g keeps moving this point around by some dynamical system, a very special dynamical system, it's called a null system. And then f is just some nice function, complex values. Nice function on this space. We often assume some regularity, so Lipschitz is common. Okay, but or just continuity or piecewise continuity. Just to simplify things, I won't talk about the technical distinctions between these different regularity classes. But some nice function. The typical model you keep in mind is that say a torus as a unit circle is a very simple example as a one-step nilpotent Lie group. And the function here is just the exponential function. That's a model example of that function we have in mind here. So anything like that's called a null sequence. And so rather than dealing with expressions involving multiple number theoretic objects correlated together, we now just need to correlate one number theoretic object and one dynamical object. And that's a simpler problem. And so, I talked before about the connections here. So the connection is actually fairly strong. If you know a lot about sums like this, and in particular into what's called the Gauss uniformity norm of these expressions, understanding expressions like this actually does imply if you have the ability to estimate expressions like this correctly, then you can estimate expressions like this. You can get a lot of good control on this, and that's actually fairly easy. In fact, ultimately, Cauchy-Schwarz many times. But what's deeper and more interesting is that conversely, if you have control of expressions like this, correlations between primed objects and dynamical objects, that does give for you control back on linear equations and primes. So the most important, the most well-known example of this is the Heidegger circle method, in which you control averages against linear dynamical one-step dynamical objects. And that lets you control some averages of this type. Like, for example, understanding good enough bounds on this particular sum actually turns out to be enough to control, for example, the count progression of S3 in the primes. But it turns out that if you want to do something, if you want to, for example, count progressions of S4 in the primes, then you need to start looking at more complicated correlations of this type. But there does appear to actually be a good inclination in the reverse direction, with the exception of these things that involve two primes, unfortunately. Yeah, so I should mention that this whole picture is very pretty, except that this is one very important class of things that it can't handle. So the rule of thumb seems to be that as long as you have at least two independent variables to average over, then there is some good chance that you can reduce things to understanding correlations for dynamical systems. But if you only have one parameter of averaging, and so if you're counting twin primes, these methods just do not seem to be enough. The problem somehow is that every dynamical system, not just these null systems, every dynamical system could conceivably influence this sum, and we have to correlate the primes of every single dynamical system, and that's just I don't think that's possible with this type of method. We have no insights as to how to predict the twin prime conjecture, for instance, for this method. But anything that involves two parameters, like progressions, we now have there seems to be a framework to do all these things. Okay, so what I want to talk so the this backwards implication is not fully settled. So there was this conjecture, it's called the inverse conjecture for the Galois norm. Which, if true, would basically allow you to convert information like this to information like this. Okay, but this is not the focus of my talk today. So, what I want to talk about today is a further reduction. Okay, so here we had many number theoretic objects. Okay, and okay, here we have one number theoretic object and one dynamical object. So that's easier to deal with. And so there's an even simpler question, which is just equidistribution. Of new sequences. So never mind primes. Just ask, what happens to root 2n mod 1? Just look at integers. Root 2n squared mod 1. Okay, so there's Dirichlet or Kronecker showed that root 2n is equidistributed mod 1. Val showed, in fact, that more generally, you take any polynomial with at least one irrational coefficient, then that is just equidistributed mod 1. What about this is equidistributed mod 1. And these questions are not entirely you think answer is yes. I mean, there's really no reason why not. But I just want to show you that there is one funny example. This expression here looks pretty irrational, right? And it is irrational. But this guy is not uniformly distributed mod 1. So there's an identity which, unfortunately, I didn't have time to write down, but let's see. The thing is that the point is that this is 0 mod 1, and this is 0 mod 1 as well. So if you play around a bit, I believe you can write this as maybe minus the fractional part of root 2n squared mod 1, something like that. I may have this sign. Okay. So the root 2n is equidistributed mod 1, and so its fractional part is equidistributed from 0 to 1, but its square is not quite equidistributed. It's a little bit biased to be small. So this expression is not quite equidistributed mod 1. Okay, so this is not entirely... this example should show you that we have vowel theoremesis that gives you a very simple criterion for when polynomials equidistribute one. Once you have bracket polynomials, it gets a little bit more tricky. And unfortunately, we have to deal with things like bracket polynomials if we want to understand these asymptotics for linear equations of primes, because as I said in the last lecture, these bracket polynomials do distort these sums, and so you can't just ignore them. You have to deal with them. So we have this problem, and that problem is essentially the problem of understanding sums like this. Okay, so understanding equidistribution of a null sequence G to the n mod x of null sequences, of orbits of null systems. Okay. That's fine. Keep that. Okay, so that's basically the question of just understanding a single this distribution for example, if you want to understand the distribution of alpha n mod 1, you have to understand just sums like this. Okay, and that you can actually just do as a geometric series, and you just do it. You have this problem, and this is clearly a simpler looking problem than the previous one, because there's no number theory anymore. It's just dynamics. Okay, but the great thing is that there are methods that let you pass from this simple. Once you understand these types of expressions, you can understand those expressions, so that's the Vinogradov's method. Okay, at least that's the most, that basically is the method. This is our approach. We have this conjecture, which is this Mobius null sequences conjecture. Which is the statement that if F is a null sequence, then you have good correlation with the Mobius function that basically the your node sequence itself, well, actually, that's a state that you can bound this. It decays faster than any power of n at a rate that depends on the dynamical data s, g, s, and so forth. But and also the Lipschitz constant of f. You have to pick a metric on the new manifold. That's just like technicality. Let me not deal with that. But it doesn't depend on g. It's uniform in the choice of group element. That's actually rather important. That's a small technicality. So the intuition here, as I said last talk, is that mu n is a very random function, and it's actually a very sort of the intuition is that it's a very unpredictable function. It should be random in many senses. Now it is of course not fully random. There are lots of structures to it. For example, mu of 2n tends to equal to minus mu of n whenever n is odd. Okay, so there's lots of structures of this type, but in general, you expect this sequence to behave pseudo-random in many, many ways. In particular, you should, if I give you a large 100-digit number, there should be just mu should be just as likely to be prime to be plus one or minus one or zero, and you shouldn't be able to tell any information about the sign. And what this is saying is that it's so random that even if you're able to compute no sequences, you still do not get much information as to what the sign of mu n is. So actually, there's a cute sort of information theoretical computational complexity interpretation of this result, which is now a theorem of Ben-Gvir and myself. That suppose you are given a really large number, like a 1,000-digit number or a huge number, and you have this calculator. It has this number, and it's also stored lots and lots of real constants, like root 2, root 3. You have stored all kinds of constants. You have this big, massive number, and you have the usual calculator operations, plus, minus, times, divide. Okay, not divide. Okay, I can't do that one. Okay, so not, okay, plus. Okay, so the divide is broken. But, but you also have the fact that you have an integer pi button as well. Okay, and you have registers. You can store things in memory. Okay, you have some bounded number of registers, and so you can take this number and you can do any number. You can do a bounded number of operations with your calculator to compute any of these expressions, and then you can look at your number. But because the screen of your calculator is so small, you can only see like 10 digits around the decimal point of any given number. So you may have a million digit number, but you can only see just a small portion near the decimal point. And I'll also allow you to see the most significant digits. Okay, so you can see the most significant digits and the digits near zero, but you don't see the whole thing. And this theorem is saying that with that calculator is useless for determining whether mu n is plus one or minus one. It offers you no information. Okay, so there is this nice sort of computer science-y sort of interpretation of that statement. Okay, so the strategy is that you want to first understand these sums as much as possible, then that's going to come from something that's going to come from a Ratner type theorem. In fact, and induction. Okay. Then by Ben-Gvir's method, that's going to give control on expressions like this. And so this is how we prove the Mobius no sequence conjecture. And hopefully, we haven't done this fully yet. By a completely different means, we should be able to settle this Galois inverse conjecture. This has nothing to do, despite connecting two number theoretic objects, this conjecture has nothing to do with number theory. It is a purely additive combinatorial statement. But it's known in some cases. But if this is true, it's also false in some cases, but that's another story. Okay, not in the case of relevance here. But if that's true, then we should eventually be able to count lots and lots of progressions of linear patterns in prime. So this is sort of our overall goal. Okay, so today I wanted to talk about this step, the Ben-Gvir step, and the Ratner step. Okay. So, actually. So actually, rather than do a no sequence, I mean, of course, we have to do with no sequences in the full generality. And in fact, for various technical reasons, we have to do even more general things than no sequences, because polynomial no sequences. But again, never mind that. Perhaps I should just begin by returning to the very classical problem of estimating just a correlation of mu, and not any fancy things, but just a simple linear phase. Okay, so basically the method used to deal with this is essentially the method we use to deal with the general case. You just have to understand this the correct way, and it just generalizes, not completely easily, but in a way which is sort of natural. Okay, so you want to control an expression like this. Okay, so of course, an average here. Okay, so you have a trivial bound of 1, and you want to improve this trivial bound. Okay, so the classical approach is to divide into two cases, which are traditionally called the major arc case and the minor arc case. But I'm going to call them, I'm going to rename them. I'm going to call this the essentially periodic case and the equidistributed case. Okay, so the periodic case is the case when alpha is a rational, alpha is very close to a rational. So alpha is very, very close to a rational. Not everybody's close to a rational, but rational with small q. Now, exactly what small means, it depends on the context. So log n is typical, but never mind exactly what small means. So think of this as alpha is very close to rational. And then this equidistributed case is alpha is not close or any small rational. Okay. Now, of course, you have to make these things much more precise. So I'm not going to do that here. Okay. And so you use different methods to deal with these two cases. So in the periodic case, okay, let's say for simplicity, alpha is equal to a over q. Then this space here is periodic mod q, and so you can split this into various sums which look something like n equals b mod q. Okay. You're summing primes. There's a Mobius function in ethnic progressions. And there are lots and lots of number theory techniques to deal with this. The basic trick is that you do some multiplicative Fourier analysis and you change this problem a little bit more. Instead of summing over residue classes, you sum over a character, which is some periodic mod Q character. And you have to understand these sort of sums. And now these guys are both multiplicative functions, so you can start hitting it with a theory of Dirichlet series. And then the theory of L functions and so forth. So, okay, I won't talk about it, but okay. So there's a huge apparatus of I think number theory which will come in and deal with this case for you. Okay, so this is the one case where we actually use number theory, and sort of for everything else we barely use anything about the sequence at all. Okay, we use one fact, which is fairly simple, and we basically focus all our energies on the dynamical part, and we squeeze out and we exploit in particular the equidistribution. Okay, so this part is heavily number theoretic, and I won't talk about it. But it's the minor arc case, which you have to start doing more dynamical systems / sort of elementary harmonic analysis. The challenge here is that you have to use something about mu. All right, for all you know, mu could just, it's plus or minus 1, but it could decide to be plus 1 whenever this sequence is on the right half of the circle, and minus 1 is on the left half of the circle, that would bias. So you need to use something about mu n. So I mentioned before, there are little formulas like that. There is some structure to the mu set that you can develop. And so it turns out that one particularly nice formula to use is this one. So there's all kinds of multiplicative identities. In fact, in many ways, in the spirit of some of the talks in this workshop, ultimately, what you want to exploit is that this type of object is in sort of an additively structured object, and this is a multiplicatively structured object, and you want some sort of tension. Do you want to exploit cancellation or proportionality? Something to the effect that multiplication and addition are, in some sense, very different. So, mu is a very multiplicative function. It obeys many multiplicative identities. Here's one of them. You have this sort of self-reproducing formula that the Mobius function at any point n can be expressed. As a system of all BNCs, their product jointly defines n of mu b mu c. In the language of Dirichlet convolutions, saying that mu is equal to mu convolve 1. In the language of zeta functions, this is saying that 1 over zeta is equal to 1 over zeta times 1 over zeta times zeta. Okay. But this identity is easy to prove. And it expresses your function as some sort of multiplicative convolution, and this is going to be a very useful identity. Okay, because let's just insert this identity here and see what we get. Okay, so now we have a much bigger sum. It's convenient, so B divides, okay, so, all right, so what is the metric used whenever you see a double sum, right, you interchange them? So, okay, so, and let's write, so B divides N, so let's write N is B times M. So what you eventually get, if B goes from 1 to N, and M is N over B, that will go, M will go from 1 to N over B, so you got mu over B, okay, I'll keep it like it's mu over B, and then you have the sum over all C's dividing M, mu of C, okay, E to the alpha VM. Okay, now, those who know number theory will know that there's something suspicious about this thing in the bracket, so ignore that for now. Okay. Okay, but so if you look at I'm missing one. Right. This is what I want. Okay. So what this is? Okay. You should think this is a bilinear expression. It's some function of B, some function of C, of M. Sorry. And then this explicit dynamical function of the product of N times M. So you have a bilinear form with two number theoretic objects and one dynamical object. So at first glance, this looks worse than what we started with. Okay, to begin with, you have one number theoretic object and you had one dynamical object. Now you have two number theoretic objects and one dynamical object. But the key is that these number theoretic objects only depend on one of the two parameters, whereas the dynamical object depends on both. And therefore, you can use the most basic weapon in harmonic analysis, the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, to eliminate these guys and only be left with the dynamical part. And so this is the type of reduction we're looking for. We want to reduce questions involving both number theory and dynamics to just questions just involving dynamics. Okay. And so, of course, you know, this Cauchy-Schwarz trick is all over. It comes from graph theory. It comes from everywhere. Story short, what you want to do now is that you want to say Cauchy-Schwarz and B to cancel this off at the cost of squaring this guy, and then you Cauchy-Schwarz and M to cancel this off at squaring that guy. And you can bound this by eventually, in principle, something like some quadruple sum of something like this E alpha N M minus alpha N M prime plus alpha N prime M, sorry, minus plus alpha N prime N prime, where N and M vary over various things. Now, there are some technical issues because these sums, the range of summations are changing. Okay, that's the technicality. I'm going to deal with it. Okay, and waste some power. Okay, so it's messy, but the point is that there's no more number theory at this point. Okay, it is just a dynamical expression. And in this simple case, it's in fact a very explicitly evaluable dynamical expression. And so if you use whatever you know about distribution of exponentials, you can get good bounds for this if you have enough equidistribution on your alphas. Okay. And so this method will work as long as alphas are equidistributed and give you good bounds. Now, there are technicalities. Okay, so one technicality is that this sum here is actually rather suspicious, actually, because if you, this is extra identity, that this expression actually turns out to be either just 1 and 0, or with 1 and 0 otherwise. And so, in fact, substitute that, you find that I've not actually told you. I've just rewritten this thing in a disguised way. So, but that's, you shouldn't just give up at that point. So actually, what you do is that you use this identity to add and subtract various key terms, there is a much more sophisticated formula of this type called Vaughan's identity, which does give you what you want. Maybe I won't use it, but just to give you a flavor of it, I'll just write down what the full thing is. So Vaughan's identity tells you that if you're correlating the Mobius function against anything, and f is not important what f is, you can write this as so this is actually just one of many identities that you can do. There are many things you can add and subtract, and it doesn't. You have to be somewhat aware of what's a good thing to do and what's not a good thing to do, but this is by no means the only thing you can do. So you sound like this, where this guy is the sum of all BCs dividing D, or BCs equal to D, sorry, where B and C are both less than equal to 1/3, mu of B and mu of C, and this expression is, maybe I shouldn't call it B of D, let me call it say G of D, is sum of all C's divided by D, C bigger than n 1/3, mu of C. It's the same type of expression you have to about goes extra cutoff, and that makes it a non-trivial expression. So basically you have some nasty number theoretic objects here, and then the dynamical objects, but the thing is that the nasty number theoretic objects only depend on one of the two variables. And you can easily dispose of them by things like Cauchy-Schwarz. In this case, just a triangle inequality would dispose of this guy. Here, you need Cauchy-Schwarz, and then you're just left with dynamical problems. And so, as long as your F is sufficiently equidistributed, you can control these things. Okay. And so, this, in a nutshell, is Vinogradov's method. Well, in a slightly modern interpretation of, but okay, the method really goes back to it. And also, just to some extent, to Hardy-Littlewood before as well. So we do use some number theory, but not much. Okay, there's no zeta functions. There's no, you know, the really heavy guns are not used here. Okay, so so what you need at the end of the day. So if you plug this method, if you just apply this method to the Mobius number sequence problem, you find that you get a good bound. Okay, you can get a nice good bound whatever you want, provided that this sequence has some good equidistribution properties. So basically, you need this sequence to be very equidistributed. Okay, and in fact, let's just say strongly equidistributed. And the type of things we're going to need are if you want to sum this expression, you want to take averages, you want to have no sequence, and suppose that F also has the additional property that has mean zero. Okay, so on this null manifold, there turns out to be a natural Haar measure you can put on this guy. And so if you ask F is mean zero, then if this is equidistributed, the classical statement of equidistribution will assert that a equivalent thing for any, say, continuous F of mean zero, this expression converges to zero. So for this application, we actually need quantitative rates of convergence better than any logarithm, power of the logarithm. So we need this. Actually, a bit more technically, we need this not just for the single orbit, but also if you dilate the orbit by some factor k. You see, because this is d and this w, and you also need similar things. You dilate by some k, and you have to divide this by k to compensate. You also need equidistribution of not quite all dilates of k, but for most dilates of k, you need very good equidistribution as well. Okay, but it turns out that the key is mostly to get the base equidistribution. Once you have this, you can also get the others. But so that's a technicality. But you want to add, so basically the point is that if your null sequence has this good equidistribution property, then this method works and you get what you want. That's one slight older simplification. One thing I should mention here is that in this analysis, I very much use the fact that this function E is multiplicative. Because then when I Cauchy-Schwarz, I get to combine things, and I get this nice exponential sum here. This is actually rather important. Suppose I wanted to control instead this expression, where instead of exponential, I have to say cosine, let's say 2 pi. Okay, cosine is very, very close to E of x. But if I try the same method directly to cosine, I will run into a problem, because when I multiply two cosines, I will get much more terms. And cosine itself is not so bad, but if I put in a more complicated function, then I do not get enough cancellation to get what I want at the end. Okay, but of course there is a trick, and the trick is Fourier decomposition. If I had an expression, if I had cosine, of course I can split cosine into e of plus ix and minus ix, And then for each separate term, I apply Vinogradov's method separately to both sums. I Cauchy Schwarz separately. So the trick is to use the triangle inequality first and then Cauchy Schwarz. And that is often strictly better than using Cauchy Schwarz first and then triangle inequality, because all the cross correlations are sort of gone already. And so there's this trick. If you don't have exponential behavior, then you must first create exponential behavior so that you get cancellation. And that is a key point. So actually, I should have mentioned the same thing happens here. That if you have a general no function f, if you apply Vaughan's identity in the Vinogradov directly to this expression, you will get in trouble unless your function behaves like a character. Now, unfortunately, because your group is not abelian, Fourier analysis is on the full group G is unpleasant. I mean, it exists, but it is not so useful as to really help you. I mean, okay, it can eventually, but it's not so great. For example, for those who know, for Noetherian groups, generally the irreducible representation is infinite dimensional. It's not so pleasant. But the thing about nilpotent groups is that they always have a center, a non-trivial center. And so and in the context of the no-manifold, that means that inside the nilpotent group there's a center, it's called Z of G, which in particular contains the highest commutator subgroup. And that acts in a that acts nicely on this group. And what it does is it splits your nasty no-manifold. Actually, also not nasty, it's like a very nice no-manifold. But but there's slightly non-abelian no-manifold, okay. But you do have abelian structure in one direction, in some directions. Okay, by moving along the center, you just get a whole bunch of copies of the center quotient by some co-compact lattice. But the thing is that you're a nasty twisted object, but in one direction, they're just nice, they're like the tori, okay, in one direction. And so you can do Fourier analysis in just this direction only. And you can decompose your function into functions that behave like characters only in this vertical direction. And so we have these things called vertical null sequences, vertical character null sequences, which I won't define here, but you can decompose any guy like this into vertical character null sequences. And those, once you have enough sort of structure like that, then that is enough algebraic structure that you get good cancellation when you apply the Vinogradov's method. Okay, so there's this additional initial trick. You first Fourier decompose, you have to do a Fourier decomposition. And then you understood. Okay. So but the upshot though is that if you have the equidistribution, then you are done. And if you have conversely, thanks to all this powerful number theory, if you have periodicity, then you're done. And if you are just doing the circle method, okay, if you're just looking at the linear case and just dealing with this, those are the only two cases. Okay, you're either irrational or you're irrational, and if you're irrational, you're equidistributed. And that's it. And so that's the end of the story. Okay, and the same method to some extent, yeah, and that's because of Vowell's theorem for equidistribution of polynomials. It's a similar thing for polynomials. If you have a polynomial here, again, polynomials are either all the coefficients are rational, in which case you just have a periodic function again, or you have one irrational coefficient, which gives you equidistribution. And so you have, these are the only two cases. And so it was already essentially in the literature that you have good correlation systems like this. I think some of those are Gosh, maybe some other people. Because the Vinogradov method just works. Okay, they cover both cases. But once you get to no sequences, you get things like this, no sequences that are not quite equidistributed, but they're not periodic either. And so you have to do something about those. Okay, and for that we need Ratner type theorem. Okay, so Ratner type theorems concern whenever you have a group quotient and you have a point, you have an orbit. Actually, the classical theorem of Ratner does not deal with discrete orbits, which is our concern, okay, but rather continuous orbits. And this is the one parameter group action you may consider higher dimensional group actions. Okay, there are many, many variants and generalizations of this type of theorem. For us, though, we want discrete actions of a single generator. And you want to know, taking orbit, you want to know, is it equidistributed in the whole space? Is it periodic, which means that, if you like, that it's equidistributed in a finite set? Or is it equidistributed in something else? Okay, so just from abstract nonsense from measure theory, you know that any orbit is equidistributed in something. you may need some ergodic theorem. Okay, but okay. You expect there to be some limit measure that this sequence equidistributes to. But the question is, what is that limiting measure? And so Wagner's theorem gives a classification, not in all cases. So there are some group quotients that are truly nasty, things that are not very nilpotent at all. But for nice, almost abelian situations such as the nilpotent situation, there are lots of nice theorems. So here's a typical one. I'm not quite sure who this is due to. I think. All right, I'm going to name a bunch of. Let me state the theorem, and I'll okay. It's different versions are due to many people, but okay. But if you have a new manifold, and you have an orbit in the new manifold, then this orbit is always going to be equidistributed in some sub-new manifold, so that there exists a sub-new manifold. Okay, where H is a closed subgroup of G, sigma is the intersection of G. So there exists a closed subgroup, and such that this guy here. Okay, S3 is in the orbit of H. Okay, so this system, for example, is stated by Sascha Liebman, but there are versions of it going back. I think Shah has some version like of something like this for continuous flows. Okay, but then there's earlier work of Parry and Green, which in principle would give you this fairly quickly. Liebman proved a much more general statement than this. Okay, so I'm not completely sure who to attribute this particular result to, but it is definitely in the literature. The model example you keep in mind is that of a torus. This is the abelian case, which you can analyze rather completely by Fourier analysis, or geometry of numbers even. Okay, so that if you have a shift x of alpha, and you look at the orbit, so it turns out the orbit is always equidistributes, not maybe in the full torus, but always in some sub-torus or some finite union of sub-torus. So now there's always some closed subgroup of the big torus, okay, which may be finite, and maybe the whole thing, maybe something intermediate. It depends on what the rational relations between the coefficients of the alphas are, but there will always be some subgroup for which this orbit is equidistributed. And it turns out that the situation in the abelian case does extend to the nilpotent case and to certain other key things as well. Where the whole thing is not important, but the single group generator that you're using does act in some unipotent manner on the algebra of the group G. But okay, I don't want to talk about that. Okay. So in principle, if you have this theorem is great because it in principle reduces you to the cases we had before. So if you have a group quotient and you have some orbit, it could be periodic, it could be equidistributed, it could be something in between. But if you know this Wagner type theorem, then if it's in between, it is equidistributed in some intermediate sub-new manifold of dimension between zero and the whole space. And if it's zero, you can use the periodic theory, and if the dimension is bigger than one, you can use equidistribution. You just need some equidistribution in some direction, and you can get cancellation. So to cut a long story short, once you have this theorem in principle, you have this. The catch, first of all, the theorems in the literature of this type are qualitative. They tell you that by equidistribution, they only mean that this thing tends to zero. For our application, we actually need a much more quantitative result. Where we have these log decays. And in particular, we need various things have to depend polynomially on other parameters. Okay, but I will not talk about these things, I have no time. There's maybe one last wrinkle I wanted to just bring up. So I have no time to. Okay, I'm not going to give a third talk. Okay, but I have no time to talk about the foolproof. But I can fly home this evening. So okay, you can't get me again. Okay, but. I'll tell you the key lemma that is used, okay, which is that there's a criterion for when you're equidistributed, when you're not, say, for no manifolds. If you're an orbit in a no manifold, and you want to know whether you're equidistributed. There's actually a nice criterion. So what you can do is that every new manifold has got a nice projection. So a nilpotent group is not abelian, but its first commutator is always a normal subgroup, and so you can always quotient by the commutator, and you get the abelianization. This is the biggest abelian quotient of your space, because of that, your new manifold projects down to an abelian new manifold, the abelianization, and that's always like a torus. Okay, and your complicated flow here just becomes a nice simple linear flow like that. And the theorem, the key lemma is that if you want to know whether a sequence up here is equidistributed, well, in order to be equidistributed up here, the projection of the sequence must be equidistributed down here. You can show that the higher measure here projects onto the higher measure down here. And it turns out that condition is also sufficient, that if you're on the abelianization you're equidistributed, then you're also equidistributed upstairs. But you can think of that as a massive generalization of Weyl's theorem. That says that if you have a polynomial where all the coefficients are irrational, if just one of the coefficients are irrational, then the whole thing, then it's equidistributed. So that's the key statement. I can't talk about the proof, but you need this and you need a quantitative version of this. And so once you have this, you can start running a dichotomy. So take a sequence up here. It may or may not be equidistributed. Project down here. Look at what's going on here. Down on the torus, you can use Fourier analysis, and you know that either you are equidistributed or you are stuck inside a lower dimensional torus, or maybe a finite unit of lower dimensional torus. So if you are equidistributed downstairs, then you're also equidistributed upstairs by this lemma, which I'm not proving. Or you are, okay, maybe I need some more dimensions to illustrate what's going on. Okay, so maybe you're really being concentrated in some subtorus here. So then you take the inverse image of that subtorus, and that turns out to be a finite union of subnormal manifold up here. And so what's going on now is that if you're concentrating it here, then your nil sequence was not actually spread out over the whole new manifold. It was in fact trapped inside some subnormal manifold or finite union of subnormal manifolds. And then you iterate. You take that object and you start all over again with that thing. Okay. And you run into coming again and again and again. But each time the dimension of the space that you're capturing the nil sequence in is going down, so the first terminate at some point. And this is essentially how you derive Ratner's theorem in an important case from this lemma. Now, that's how it's done in the qualitative world, where you keep a little of ones, and also where, but there is a slight wrinkle, the very last thing to talk about, in the quantitative case. So there is this annoying example. It's a skew shift system. So take the following system on a skew torus. You take x comma y, gets mapped to you shift x just by a little bit, and then you shift y by x. Okay. So you move a little bit and then you shift up based on what your x coordinate is. Then you move a little bit and shift up again. So this turns out to be you can model this by a nil system. I in fact mentioned this what it would be last lecture. Okay, so call this action. So this is your group action. Okay, so look at the nth orbit of 0, 0. So that's like n over big N, n plus 1 and minus 1 over 2, n, no, 1 over n, something like that. Okay, so you start at the origin and you look at the orbit up to time n. Time n over 100. Pretty good. Okay. So to begin with, nothing much changes. If n is really huge, your x is being shifted by something very tiny, and you're not seeing and y is not moving at all. Okay. So for the first few orbits, nothing is really moving. But eventually, because of this quadratic behavior here, by the time n reaches about root n, okay, the sequence will start to slowly slide up, very slowly slide up, like this. And it will eventually sort of hover around here for a long time. And then by the time you get to n1, it will go up and down and up and down, and it will eventually end up maybe about distance 100 from the origin. But it will have journeyed, it will have wrapped around the vertical direction a lot, okay, and it will be in fact quite equidistributed in the vertical direction. So that's the orbit. So this system projects down to the Beanization system is just a circle shift down here. Okay, and you're only moving by a little bit, and we have to keep everything quantitative, so we have to keep track of exactly how much you're moving. So if you're only moving by, say, 1/100, or let's say log n or something, okay, then from the view of the Beanization, you have not moved. Okay, so you are close to, but you're not actually, you're close to being stuck in a single point, but you're not actually at that single point. So the orbit here is close to the inverse orbit, so you're close to being this no-manifold, but you're not actually on this no-manifold. So there's this additional step which is not present in the soft infinitary world where you just look at the asymptotic limit, but when you're fixing an n, you care very much about that single n, you're not allowed to move n around, and you want bounds on that n. You have to take this sequence which is drifting, slowly drifting away from it, and you have to project it. You have to correct for the drift and actually whack it back exactly onto the no-manifold so that you can induct properly. And the problem is that when you do so, this linear sequence becomes a quadratic sequence. Okay, it's just the product, when you're in a non-Abelian group, the product of two linear sequences can be a quadratic sequence. Okay, it can have higher order terms. Although in an important group, it terminates eventually. And so starting with linear sequences, even if all you care about is linear sequences, for the purpose of induction, you're forced to also consider polynomial sequences. And so you actually have to redo a lot of the previous arguments for all linear sequences replaced by polynomial sequences in order to get the induction going correctly. And that is a technical headache, but I will not talk about that. Thank you very much.